So the title of my talk, as Shubha has just said, is The Buddha Jewel and the Maha Parinirvana Sutta. And I'm going to repeat something that Shubha said earlier, that we are using this sutra, the Maha Parinirvana Sutra, as the core text for this year. So we'll be drawing from this text throughout the year. Well, we had a theme all throughout last year, we've got a theme throughout this year. So the core text will be the Maha Parinirvana Sutra to align with the theme of the spiritual death at the London Buddhist Centre in 2012. I'm repeating what you said earlier. And as Shubha actually said, the Parinirvana Sutra sort of recounts the last months, really, the last, you know, the end of the Buddha's life and his teachings, and also his passing away. So, as well as focusing on that sutra, we'll also be focusing on the threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom this year. And the reason for that is that in his last months, the Buddha again and again reminded his followers that the main building blocks of the spiritual life are sila, samadhi and prajna, which is ethics, meditation and wisdom. So, and he does actually repeatedly throughout this sutra, just repeats it again and again. And the Buddha didn't do things lightly. If he was insisting on that teaching, it's because that is a very, very important teaching for us. So that theme of ethics, meditation and wisdom will run throughout the year as well. And in this first session, we're going to be exploring the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And Bhante, our teacher, Sangharakshita, says that what makes us Buddhists is this central act of going for refuge to the three jewels. So my talk tonight focuses on the Buddha Vandana. I'll explain that word in a minute. And then in a few weeks' time, Shubha will be exploring the Dharma Vandana. And after that, Pranya Devi will be exploring the Sangha Vandana. So we will be looking in some detail at the three jewels. And the word Vandana means salutation, respect, homage, veneration and worship. So it's about sort of venerating, worshipping the three jewels. And you may have encountered the word Vandana in the set of traditional Pali verses of praise for the three jewels in the Puja book. I don't know if anybody's come across the Tiratna Vandana. The Tiratna Vandana often in our movement is actually chanted before morning meditation as a way of actually bringing the three jewels into the centre of our lives. The Tiratna Vandana has within it the words of the Buddha that comes from the Maha Parinirvana Sutta, in particular the section called the Mirror of the Dharma. So in actual fact, when you look at the Tiratna Vandana, some of the words used in there come directly from the Mirror of the Dharma, which is from the Maha Parinirvana Sutta. So the Mirror of the Dharma is a teaching that the Buddha gives his companion Ananda after he's asked the Buddha innumerable times on behalf of other people. I mean, Ananda was very obliging, so if people came and asked him questions, he'd go and approach the Buddha. Time and time again, he asked the Buddha what happened to a great number of monks, nuns and lay people after their death. So the Buddha very patiently gives Ananda, sort of, he does respond, telling him what happened after death to hundreds of his followers who've gained insight. But Ananda keeps asking, you know, and what happened to this person? And what happened to that person? Until he says, whoa, stop, he says. And he gives Ananda the following teaching contained in the mirror of the Dharma, so that he no longer has to keep asking questions about what happened to different people after they've died. The Buddha says that through the mirror of the Dharma, we can see for ourselves where we are on the spiritual path. So rather than keep asking, you know, have they become enlightened? Have they broken this fetter? Have they gained insight? The Buddha actually gives this teaching so that Ananda and all of us can actually sort of gauge. It's holding up a mirror to us about where we are in the spiritual path. So I'm going to read the section from the Parinirvana Sutta called The Mirror of the Dharma. And, I mean, this evening I'm concentrating on the Buddha jewel, but this talks about all the three jewels. So the Buddha says, "But truly, Ananda, it is nothing strange that human beings should die. But if each time it happens, you should come to the Tathagata and ask about them in this manner, indeed, it would be troublesome to him." Actually, that's a very polite way of putting it. "Therefore, Ananda, I will give you the teaching called the Mirror of the Dharma, possessing which the noble disciple, should he or she desire, can declare of herself, 'There is no more rebirth for me in hell, nor as an animal or ghost, nor in any realm of woe. A stream enterer am I, safe from falling into the states of misery. Assured am I, and bound for enlightenment.'" So this is what this teaching can actually do for us. "And what, Ananda, is that teaching called the Mirror of the Dharma, possessing which the noble disciple may thus declare of himself or herself? In this case, Ananda, the noble disciple possesses unwavering faith in the Buddha thus. The Blessed One is an Arahant, the fully enlightened one, perfect in knowledge and conduct, the happy one, the knower of the world, the paramount trainer of beings, the teacher of gods and men, the enlightened one, the blessed one. She possesses unwavering faith in the Dharma thus. Well propounded by the Blessed One is the Dharma, evident, timeless, inviting investigation, leading to emancipation, to be comprehended by the wise, each for herself. She possesses unwavering faith in the Blessed One's order of disciples thus. Well-faring is the Blessed One's order of disciples. Righteously, wisely and dutifully, that is to say, the four pairs, the eight classes of persons, the Blessed One's order of disciples is worthy of honour, of hospitality, of offerings, of veneration, the supreme field for meritorious deeds in the world. And she possesses virtues that are dear to the noble ones, complete and perfect, spotless and pure, which are liberating, praised by the wise, uninfluenced by worldly concerns, and favourable to concentration of mind. This, Ananda, is the teaching called the Mirror of the Dharma, whereby the noble disciple may thus know of herself. There is no more rebirth for me in hell, nor as an animal or ghost, nor in any realm of woe. A stream enterer am I, safe from falling into the states of misery. Assured am I, and bound for enlightenment. So the Buddha is actually saying in the mirror of the Dharma that if we have complete confidence and unwavering faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and spotless and pure ethical behavior, then we can say with confidence that we are a stream entrant. So it's, in other words, going for refuge to the three jewels and following the path of the precepts, of the ethical precepts. So that actually makes one a stream entrant. And just as a reminder, because I'm sure most of us know what a stream entrant is someone who's entered the stream, that is, the stream that eventually leads to nirvana. Someone who has turned her main focus away from the conditioned to the unconditioned, and no longer suffers the risk of falling back. The stream entrant has developed a degree of insight powerful enough to break the first three of the ten fetters. So the first three fetters are being free from self-view or self-belief. That's the first one. The second one is doubt or indecision. And the third one is dependence on moral rules and religious observances as ends in themselves. So once you break those three fetters, then you enter the stream, you become a stream entrant. And what's very interesting is the second one, doubt or indecision, is the same as unwavering faith, actually, and complete confidence in the three jewels. That implies that you have no doubt or indecision. So we can hold this mirror of the Dharma for ourselves and for others. Unwavering faith and complete confidence in the three jewels. In terms of spotless virtue, that sounds a little bit sort of, you know, not really in my experience anyway. In terms of spotless virtue, a stream entrant is not enlightened and is still subject to greed and hatred. So becoming a stream entrant, entering the stream, heading, you know, your main focus is towards enlightenment and the unconditioned. But you're still subject to greed and hatred. So the stream entrant still actually breaks the precepts. But a stream entrant has got such refined awareness that the stream entrant immediately realizes that they've broken a precept and immediately make amends. So, So when we say we are going for refuge to the three jewels with weighty conviction, and when we abide by the precepts, then we can have confidence that we have entered the stream. So that's a nice guideline, isn't it? Unwavering faith in the three jewels and abiding by the precepts. So we can all attempt to do something along those lines, can't we? So what I want to do with the rest of my talk is firstly ensure we understand what we are having confidence in when we go for refuge to the first jewel, the Buddha. And secondly, explore how we can test our own practice. Can we honestly say we have unwavering confidence in the three jewels and the precepts? I think, you know, most of us, you know, we do go for refuge to the three jewels. We do try to live our lives according to the precepts. But is it unwavering? Do we have unwavering faith and confidence in the three jewels? And do we continuously keep the precepts in mind? Are we growing and developing as human beings as a result of following the Dharma? These are important questions. These are questions that we should be asking ourselves all the time, actually. Is this working for me? Am I growing? Am I developing spiritually? So let's look again at the words of the mirror of the Dharma in relation to the first jewel. The Buddha says, the noble disciple possesses unwavering faith in the Buddha thus. So the noble disciple says, the Blessed One, and believes confidently that the Blessed One is an Arahant, the fully enlightened one, perfect in knowledge and conduct, the happy one, the knower of the world, the paramount trainer of beings, the teacher of gods and men, the enlightened one, the blessed one. So Subhuti has given a very good talk on the Buddha Vandana, in fact on all three Vandanas actually, on all the three jewels. And you can listen to it on Free Buddhist Audio, where he unpacks the meanings of each of these qualities of the Buddha. So we're just exploring the qualities of the Buddha. And he gives it very, very fully, but I'm just briefly going to summarise, actually, what each of these qualities mean, to try and give us a flavour of why we are going for refuge to the Buddha. You know, what are we having confidence in when we go for refuge to the Buddha? So, firstly, the Buddha is truly awake. You know, the Blessed One is an Arahant, the fully enlightened one. So he's truly awake while we are still asleep and dreaming. And because he's not compulsively chasing pleasures and running away from fears, he is free, while we are imprisoned by the delusional reality we experience. So, you know, there is a difference between the Buddha and ourselves, or at least some of us, in the fact that he's broken through. He has actually broken through. He is perfect in knowledge. So he deeply understands the nature of reality. He possesses the esoteric knowledge of how things are and how they work in the world. So he understands, he has the theory about what the nature of reality is. But he is also perfect in conduct. He has complete, perfect, spotless and pure conduct. So he understands the theory or knowledge about the nature of reality, and he knows how to apply it in the world for himself and others. In other words, his insight is not merely an intellectual understanding. He actually walks his talk. He is the happy one. He has attained to real happiness. He is perfectly at ease because he is living in reality and not in delusion. He knows where he's going. He knows that he's complete in, you know, in himself. So he's, you know, he's perfectly at ease, perfectly happy, full of joy. He is the knower of the world. His vision is beyond anything we can conceive, beyond anything we can imagine. He knows and has fully seen and understood all the different worlds. It's not that he has encountered every world, but because he has seen the fundamental way things work, he has understood the fundamental character and nature of all possible worlds. So although he lived over 2,500 years ago, his teachings apply as much today as they did in his days, because he fully understood the nature of reality, the nature of being human. So the next quality is that he is paramount. He is unsurpassed, foremost, far above any other teacher, and therefore far more important to us than any currently fashionable writer or thinker. So, paramount. He is a trainer of beings. He is capable of and desires to train those of us who wish to be more controlled and not enslaved to greed, hatred and delusion. So he is the teacher we need to follow. He understands the nature of human beings, and as an effective teacher, knows how to draw us out. We've all encountered good teachers, haven't we, that actually really bring us out of ourselves, really make us understand. So The Buddha has that quality. And the last quality is that he is a teacher of gods and men. So he's a teacher of all conscious beings, including beings in other dimensions of reality. He's not confined to the material dimension. The Buddha can interact with beings in the dream or imaginal dimensions as well. So he's capable of teaching us, teaching gods, and other beings in other dimensions. So these are the qualities of the Buddha as outlined in the Mirror of the Dharma. And these words of praise to him may mean something to us, or they may not bring up much in the way of an emotional response. We need to use our imagination to bring them to life and to engage our emotions with them. We need to make an imaginative effort to conjure up for ourselves a Buddha who is not an ordinary human being, but a being of a different order, someone who experiences a higher and truer reality and is seeking to save us from our unnecessary suffering by opening our eyes to this different dimension of being. The Buddha is beyond our present experience, and imagination and faith are the faculties by which we can experience at least a glimmer of his nature. If we can experience something of this glimmer, we will become one of the noble disciples who possesses unwavering faith in the Buddha. We will become one of those noble disciples who go for refuge to the Buddha jewel. So it's worth actually really trying to understand the qualities of the Buddha, because if we're going to go for refuge to the Buddha, if we're going to put our unwavering confidence and faith in the Buddha, we need to understand what it is that we are sort of turning towards. So those are the qualities of the Buddha. But now come the crucial questions for us. Do we have unwavering confidence in the three jewels? Are we motivated to follow the ethical path contained in the precepts? Are we effectively going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha? In order to answer these questions, we need to understand what going for refuge actually means. It took me a long while to really get into what do we mean by going for refuge? What is going for refuge to the three jewels, to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha? So Sangha Rakshita gives us a definition, quite immediate and to the point, and he says, by going for refuge, I mean actually committing oneself to the realization of the ideal of human enlightenment in this very life, and being prepared to give up whatever stands in the way of that commitment. That I find that definition quite strong. I'm going to repeat it actually. He says, by going for refuge, I mean actually committing oneself to the realization of the ideal of human enlightenment in this very life, and being prepared to give up whatever stands in the way of that commitment. I find that very strong. Kulananda, another order member in our movement, gives us a poetic rendering of what going for refuge means in his book Teachers of Enlightenment. I don't know if anybody's come across that book. It's a really good book. And I'll explain what the refuge tree is, because he mentions it actually in the quote that I'm going to read. So when you ask for ordination, you are able to actually take up a very, very beautiful practice called the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice. And in this practice, you visualize a refuge tree. And on the refuge tree, I mean, it's massive, because on the refuge tree are the teachers of enlightenment of the present, the past and the future. And there's lots of them. And it takes you a long time to really get a sense of each of these teachers. And that's why that book, Teachers of Enlightenment, is so helpful. because he actually goes through each of the figures on the refuge tree. Yeah, Kulyananda's book is really helpful in bringing all these teachers to life. So he does mention the refuge tree. I just wanted you to understand when he talks about the refuge tree. Kulyananda says, in going for refuge to the three jewels, to whatever degree we do it, we place our ego identity within the field of the bodhicitta, the field of spiritual influence which radiates out from the great refuge tree. And the more we go for refuge, the more fully and deeply do we locate ourselves within it. In going for refuge more and more effectively, we come in time to value the field within which our ego operates as much as, and in due course more than, the ego itself. That tipping of the balance from predominantly valuing the ego to predominantly valuing the field of spiritual influence that surrounds the ego is the real going for refuge. The true purpose of my life is not to serve my own ends, but to carry on the work of all the figures on the refuge tree. If only I can put myself at their disposal and surrender myself to the stream of spiritual influence that radiates from the Buddha Shakyamuni, then I am living out of my own true place in the universe, and my life has real meaning. I get very moved by that quote. So we can go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. We can commit ourselves to this spiritual path, but it's not always easy to see if we are growing and developing as human beings. I find that the most inspiring thing about the Buddha and his Dharma is the fact that he lays it out there. You know, the Buddha actually tells us the steps to follow in order for us to become stream entrants, to become enlightened. I mean, it's very, very clear. I mean, very often people say, you know, you read a good book of literature and they say, look, this is the, you know, this is what the Buddha is saying. You know, Proust, for example, is saying the same thing as the Buddha. And my answer to that is, yes, that's true. You know, there have been, you know, writers who actually capture the truth with a capital T, but do they give us the steps in order to actually make that permanent? No, they don't. They sort of hold the carrot and they don't actually show us how to get towards the carrot. What I really love about the Buddha is that in his wisdom and in his compassion, he saw the truth and he found the way to communicate the way that we can make that truth our own too, through our own efforts. So, it's not always easy to see if we're growing and developing as human beings, even though we have the Buddha's teachings. It isn't necessarily going to be obvious whether or not any particular action, practice, or initiative is actually conducive to spiritual growth. This was a dilemma that was faced by the Buddha's aunt and foster mother, Mahaprajapati Gautami, who had followed in his footsteps and become a homeless wanderer. She became one of his disciples. And the story is well known. One day she came to the Buddha, rather upset and disturbed. She didn't know what to think. The Buddha's disciples were giving out different versions of the Dharma. Some said that he taught this, others that he taught that, and so she had become confused. How was she to know what the Buddha really taught? What was really the Dharma? So she went to the Buddha and said, "How do I know what is your Dharma?" And the Buddha told her not to worry, that she should take it like this. Whatever you find in practice conduces to peace of mind, conduces to purity, conduces to seclusion, conduces to fewness of desires, conduces to contentment, conduces to insight and wisdom and detachment from the world, conduces to an understanding of the transcendental. Whatever you find in your own experience conduces to these ends, take that as my Dharma, take that as my teaching. So the Buddha has given us criteria, he's given us guidelines to see for ourselves whether or not we're growing and developing on the spiritual path. In the mirror of the Dharma, it's unwavering faith and complete confidence in the three jewels and spotless virtue. In the response to Mahaprajapati, he says that if whatever you are doing works, if it helps you spiritually, it's his teaching. If you find in your own experience that your practice helps you become more concentrated, more sensitive, more insightful, wiser, kinder, more understanding, that is his Dharma. So the Buddha actually throws it back on, throws it back on ourselves, which is quite empowering, actually. So he's actually saying, you know, see for yourself where you are. Don't depend on other people to actually tell you where you are. You can see for yourself. So that's very empowering, but actually quite difficult, because it requires complete honesty. We do really have to be completely honest about where we are, in what we're doing in our spiritual path. And it also requires a lot of awareness. We need to be quite aware of what we're doing. Does it lead to peace? Does it lead to insight? Does it lead to contentment? So, it's about being very, very aware of your practice, what you're doing, and, you know, what's happening to you. Is it working for you? We need to keep asking ourselves the question of whatever we do, is this helping me to grow spiritually? So we need to be continually evaluating. And if we can honestly say that it is, then we should continue with confidence. In order to keep ourselves motivated, so, you know, it's quite an arduous task, you know, really staying on the spiritual path, putting the commitment behind the spiritual path, behind our practice. It's sometimes not easy. And we need to keep ourselves motivated. We need to actually just see, am I going? Am I moving on? And in order to keep ourselves motivated, it's helpful to look back on our experience since we encountered the Dharma. I think it's really good to actually not just see yourself, but your friends as well, because people grow through the spiritual, following the spiritual path. And I find it very inspiring to observe, say, how friends have grown. I find that really, really inspiring. And I also find it very motivating to actually think back, you know, to all those years when I first encountered the Dharma, how I was then and how I am today. And I'm definitely a better person. And it's good to actually remind ourselves of that. So can we look back and honestly say that we have become more concentrated, more sensitive, more insightful, wiser, kinder, and more understanding? If we can say yes to even one of those criteria, then we're on the right path and we're moving towards stream entry and enlightenment. So that's actually quite a good thing to do as a reflection. Think back about, you know, have you grown? Are you more content? Are you more at peace? Are you happier with the spiritual, you know, with your meditation, with study of the Dharma, and so on? So I'm going to look back and I'm going to tell you about a very important experience that I had in July 1998. that was a real turning point in my life and has given me confidence in the spiritual path that I'm following. So I know that some of you have heard this before, so you're going to have to bear with me, because I'm old and old people repeat themselves. but also because it was quite a turn. It was a really, really important experience for me. And it has given me confidence that I am actually on the right path. So the experience I'm going to tell you about actually began a year earlier, in February 1997. And all my life, I'd been struggling with issues of lack of self-confidence, lack of self-worth. I mean, my life has been marked through chronic lack of self-confidence. Sometimes people say, no, you're not, you don't lack confidence. But I knew inside that there was a real lack of self-confidence, a real lack of self-worth. And I struggled with that all my life. Until July 1998. So in February 1997, you know, I'd worked really, really hard to overcome my lack of self-worth and lack of self-confidence. And I did that through external things, so through following a career, for example. And I worked really, really hard at my career. And in February 1997, I'd become head of faculty at a college. I was line managing 48 members of staff. How do you manage 48 members of staff? I don't know. But anyway, I was managing 48 members of staff and was well regarded and well respected in my place of work. So I thought, at last, I've gained the confidence I've been looking for. So I felt quite confident. I thought, yeah, I've gained it. I've gained that confidence. And then I took my students on work experience to France, and not knowing my way around Paris, and I did have A-level French actually, but that was over 20 years ago, before that, and I was never taught actually to speak fluently in those days, way back in those days when you learnt a language, you learnt to read and write and listen, but not to talk very much. So my pidgin French, and I had to go and visit the employers of my students, and very often if you don't speak the language properly, people just, they dismiss you, don't they? They do. I bear that in mind now, because I think just because they don't speak my language doesn't mean to say that they don't know what they're talking about. But I felt that I was quite dismissed by the employers. And I found it really difficult to find my way around the Paris metro. And all of that really rocked my confidence. You know, there was me at home feeling really, really confident. And, you know, just this experience just rocked my confidence. And I came back to London and the next day went on retreat to Tiruvannalokam. And Tiruvannalokam is the retreat centre for people who've asked for ordination. So, you know, they're very, very strong retreats. And to my horror, I came to understand that I had not gained real confidence at all, that my confidence really depended on being in a particular place surrounded by props that held me up. Actually, as soon as you took me out of that secure place, I had no confidence at all. And I really got upset. I thought, I've worked so hard. And really, I've not got confidence. I'm just as bad as I was 20 years ago. I was really, really upset. And what made it worse is that I uncovered through the imaginal realm. I don't know if sometimes you're in meditation and, the imaginal realm opens up. I sort of uncovered this kind of greed root, like a greed monster really inside me that was actually grabbing more and more. And when I looked behind, it was almost like building a high wall. And when I looked behind, there was a very young girl, frightened, lacking confidence, not thinking she's worth anything. And I just thought, oh my goodness, I was really devastated actually on that retreat. And it was very strong because it came immediately after that work experience to visit to Paris. So the next year, in July 1998, I went again to Tiruvannamalai, and I did a very beautiful retreat called the Mythic Context Retreat. And on the Mythic Context Retreat, you do the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice every day, sometimes twice a day. And I'd been doing the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice for 4 years. And I loved the practice. I really enjoyed doing that practice. And on one day, I was actually doing this Going for Refuge and Prostration practice. And again, the imaginal realm, now and again, it doesn't happen that often to me. I'm not very visual. But now and again, it sort of takes me out of myself into a completely different realm. And I found myself in this beautiful, magic secret garden where everything was in harmony, everything was at peace, everything was beautiful. It just, you know, all these luscious trees and plants, and it just felt like a holy place, really. And I went round the corner and I found the Buddha, and the Buddha was holding his hand out to me. So it was a very, very strong experience. And when I came back into the room, when I finished, and I don't know how long, that it felt like out of time and space, but it was a very beautiful experience. I felt quite disoriented. I felt, something's happened to me. I'm not quite sure. I don't feel, you know, quite right. I sort of asked myself the question, what's going on? And a friend actually lay me down, because I was feeling really a bit sort of... She lay me down and got me a cup of tea, and I sort of thought to myself, wonder what's happened? And what immediately came to mind was that the greed root I'd uncovered the year before had been transformed into a beautiful white lotus bud. And all I had to do was to nourish it, and it would... blossom into a full white lotus flower. All I needed to do was just to nurture that. And with hindsight, the confidence I'd been desperately searching for out there was actually in my heart all the time. I mean, I was brought up as a Catholic and with the concept of original sin. And I had read about, you know, that in Buddhism it isn't about original sin, it's about original purity. And I had like an experiential, or like an experience of that, that I am, and so are all of we, essentially pure. And since that time, I've developed a very healthy sense of my own self-worth and confidence in my own potential. I mean, I didn't sort of understand it then, but actually looking back, I actually think that's when I really gained in confidence. And that's the confidence I was looking for. And it was the confidence that I can actually become a stream entrant. I can actually become enlightened, you know, with time. And that, I feel, is the fruit of my practice. So we practice and we get fruit. So... I mean, this is a small fruit of my practice, but I do feel confident. I do feel confident that I'm on the right path, that I'm doing the right thing. I just need to continue with that practice. And then that little white lotus bud will open out into a full-blown lotus flower. So it's quite interesting. Bhante was once asked, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but just bear with me. He was once asked what he would choose, you know, if he was offered enlightenment or £1 million. And Bhante said, obviously tongue in cheek, he said, oh, £1 million every time, he said, because if I practice, enlightenment is guaranteed. But I've got no guarantee that anybody's going to offer me £1 million ever again. So that puts it really, really well, in the sense that we just need to practice. The Buddha has laid it out for us. I know it's not easy actually, but it's all there for us. All we need to do is just continue practicing. So I've always loved it when I hear people saying, I've heard in the past people saying, oh, I, you know, know, I think I can, I'm confident that I can become a stream entrant. I used to love hearing people saying that, because it sort of thinks, well, they've got confidence, and then I can become a stream entrant as well. So I'm going to repeat it. I've just said it, but I'm going to repeat it again. I am confident that I can become a stream entrant. All I need to do is just continue practicing. It's just continue my effort in the right direction. Continue meditating, giving myself space, going on retreat, studying, and the path is guaranteed. Yeah. You know, after all, the Buddha held up the mirror of the Dharma. You know, we've got the mirror of the Dharma. And told us that with unwavering confidence and faith in the three jewels and following the path of the precepts, we can become stream entrants ourselves. I'm overwhelmed by the wisdom and compassion the Buddha demonstrated after his enlightenment. I get incredibly moved, because his first reaction was actually not to teach. He thought, this truth is so deep that nobody will understand. And I'm really glad that he changed his mind. I get very overwhelmed by his determination. He decided to teach so that you and I can find our way out of suffering and into total freedom. So I will end showing my respect and veneration to the Buddha by reading the Buddha Vandana section of the Tiratna Vandana. And I'm going to give you a copy of, I'm going to give you all a copy of this after, you know, in a little while. But the Tiratna Vandana, and some of these, some of the words here you'll recognize from the mirror of the Dharma. So it says, such indeed is he, the richly endowed, the free, the fully and perfectly awake, equipped with knowledge and practice, the happily attained, knower of the worlds, guide unsurpassed of men to be tamed, the teacher of gods and men, the awakened one, richly endowed. All my life I go for refuge to the awakened one, to all the awakened of the past, to all the awakened yet to be, to all the awakened that now are. My worship flows unceasingly. No other refuge than the wake. Refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory.